Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
My first guest is one of Ireland's legendary newspaper men. Paddy Murray was for decades a well-known journalist, editor and columnist with independent newspapers, including a stint as editor of the Sunday Tribune. His 46-year relationship with the newspaper group ended in 2019 when his Sunday World column was axed. Paddy has penned a memoir, but it's not your typical autobiography, and finally tells the story of Paddy's life through more than 60 years, 250 stories and eyewitness accounts of breaking news, celebrity meetings, epic sporting moments and personal tragedies. And Paddy Murray joins me now. Good morning, Paddy.
Good morning, Miriam.
It's a great read, A Journalist's Life in 250 Stories. Listen, why am I suspicious that it was a challenge to distill your life and career down to a mere 250?
Well, it's 250 with probably the first 250 that came to mind. And since it went to publication, I say another 250 have come into my head. I have a memory which is useless academically, but very useful for things that don't matter.
Well, it's working for you, Paddy. Now, listen, some of these stories, they are quite remarkable. I mean, they give insights into big stories and famous people. Are they all true, Paddy, or are there a few tall tales in there too?
I think they're all true, but you see, the thing is, Miriam, 40 years ago when I started in journalism, everything was contact, human contact, knocking on doors, going to conferences. Nothing was done remotely. So that's where we all got great stories. All of us of that era experienced the same things I did.
And you admit in the book, I think, Paddy, to fabricating one story that appeared in the papers. Tell me about it.
I was sent to Cheltenham to do the diary. In other words, the non-racing stuff, the personality stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not a racing fan, so I didn't know anybody. And the late Ray Smith kind of filled in the gaps for me. He introduced me to racing people. But on day three, I had nothing left. I was bereft of stories. And someone just said, the Queen Mother's arrived. I said, yeah, big deal, that's another line. But I go out and wave at her anyway, which I did. And I came back and sat at my desk and said, one more line, the Queen Mother arrived. Then I thought, hold on a second. Micheál O'Hare had become ill 6 months previously and wasn't at Cheltenham. So I thought, I have a good one here. So I typed out, the Queen Mother arrived in Cheltenham yesterday. And the first thing she did was ask, how is Micheál O'Hare? And I filed that story because in the back of my mind, I knew the palace wasn't going to deny it. They weren't going to say, no, she didn't. So, as it happens, three English papers copied the story the following day.
And the Herald actually ran with it, though you admitted to making it up to them, didn't you, Paddy?
No. No. Sometimes afterwards I did, but I thought, maybe it's true anyway. Maybe she did.
Now, listen, the last time you and I spoke, Paddy, I think it was exactly a year ago, and we talked about the threat from COVID-19 to people like you, because you, Paddy, have serious underlying lung conditions. First of all, how has the past 12 months been for you? And tell our listeners what your condition is and how your health is, Paddy.
Well, my condition is COPD stage 4. And as I said at the time, there's no stage 5. I'm immunocompromised following a bone marrow transplant 13 years ago. So I'm pretty open to infection. I've been in hospital as an inpatient 16 times in 12 years. From infections, but I've had no infection now for 14 months because I really haven't been anywhere to get one. I had a piece in the Irish Times last week saying that there are people saying we've had enough of this now, it's been a year. And I was imagining if people had said the same thing in London in 1941 during the war, we don't want any more air raid sirens, all that stuff. You can't give up the war until you've beaten the enemy. And the enemy is COVID and we haven't won it. And as long as people aren't prepared to fight the fight, we won't win it. Now, some of the reaction of what I wrote last week was people saying, well, people like me should just lock ourselves away and that's that. I don't think that's pretty fair, do you?
No.
We should just lock ourselves away forever?
Tell me a bit more about your background, Paddy, before we get into how you got into journalism. I know you're a Dub. Where in Dublin did you grow up? And tell me about your folks.
It sounds very privileged. I grew up in a semi-detached house in Mount Marion. There were six children in the family. My dad was chairman of the ESB. I would regard us as having been very, very lucky because I've fantastic siblings and parents. They're the ones you would have chosen. I went to Blackrock, a school I loved, even though I didn't behave myself. And I just regard my childhood as idyllic.
And I think even as a small child, were you publishing newspapers to beat the band?
I brought out the Daily Midget when I was 5 or 6, a little thing I drew and used to sell to my family and my neighbours. And then when the ESB went on strike, so did the Daily Midget. And I demanded 6 pence from my father, which I got. He conceded, and I got 6 pence for the Daily Midget.
And listen, going to Black Rock and Willow Park, you loved rugby, didn't you? Did you get to play? Were you any good?
I wasn't as good as I thought I was. I lost my place and I didn't fight for it. I think in the back of my mind I knew I wasn't going to get it. The guy who took my place was better than I was. So I played in the Golden Oldies when I was 40 years of age and got sent off in my last game ever for abusing the referee, which probably sums up my rugby career.
Now listen, as you said, secondary school didn't go that brilliantly for you, although you loved it. You got a place at UCT and you studied commerce. Did you study commerce?
No, I didn't study. I went to 7 lectures in the whole year. And I was in the library once and I was dressed as a rabbit.
Why were you dressed as a rabbit?
I was advertising a show we were doing. So I bounced into the library and dressed as a rabbit and advertised the show that way.
And you met some great people there, including the late, great Dermot Morgan, didn't you?
Yeah, myself and Billy McGrann and Brendan Martin and two other guys, Brian McCormack and Kevin Kiley, we used to have a comedy group called The Milligan Machine. And Dermot had a comedy group called Big Gum and the Imbeciles. And we were kind of rivals, but we were friendly rivals, so we got to know each other. And Dermot and I eventually ended up both working on the live mic. Me as a writer, he is, among other things, Father Trendy, the precursor to Father Ted. Dermot and I, we grew up very close to each other. And we were friends. I wouldn't say the closest of friends. We were friends for many, many years.
He was a brilliant talent, wasn't he, Paddy?
Oh, he was. And he was always going to be what he eventually became, like a comedy star. I mean, one of the things I loved in my favourite stories of Dermot was he asked me to go to a late-night review he was doing in the Oscar Theatre in Ballsbridge. So it was a midnight thing. So when we all got there, most people, it was men with a few jars on. And Dermot said, don't miss the opening. So I got there, sitting in my seat, and a spotlight shone on the stage. And a woman appeared from in between the curtains, and she was absolutely stark naked. And she said, may I have your attention, please? Which I thought was absolutely brilliant. I just say to an audience full of men and seem naked, may I have your attention? I thought it was just the best comedy line I'd ever heard.
Since he was your age and you knew him so well, Paddy, how shocked were you when you heard that he had died?
I was actually in England at the time on business. So I was asked to file some stuff about him back to the Star, and I couldn't really do it, but I did it, but I was crying all the way through it. And they had a memorial service from there before they brought his body back here. And I was at that, and it was tough because I didn't really know many other people there, you know, that kind of way. I was mourning on my own. And then I met Marion at the funeral. It was the first time I'd ever seen a hearse applauded away from a church, which was very moving as well. Oh, it was just so tough. I mean, Dermot, he's 45 years of age. And at the time, Liam Mackey and myself used to have a radio program produced by a guy called Brennan Cronin, who got Dermot to come on our show. And he caused chaos. It was a live program on a Saturday morning. And he just came in and caused chaos. our producer didn't tell us he was going to be on. So he came in and just wrecked the place. And it was brilliant. It was really brilliant.
How did you go into journalism and why, Paddy? I mean, it wasn't in your family, as you say. Your dad had a, you know, sensible, pensionable job. How come you went into journalism?
I had a great career as a buzzer boy in a trendy hamburger restaurant in London in the summer of 1972. And having failed commerce, I was happy enough doing what I was doing. And I got a call from my brother saying my mother had got me into a journalism course in Rep Mines. And for some reason, I don't know what, I came home. But Rep Mines I enjoy because the late Louis MacRedmond, former editor of the Indo, was head of the course. And I think the most important thing he taught us there was that when we left, we didn't know very much. That was an important thing to know starting out in your career. Mm-hmm. And I was offered a job in the Indo, which I didn't want to take, but which my father wanted me to take. I think he thought it was time I took life seriously. So I did, and I started in the Indo on the 9th of July, 1973, and I left it in April 2019.
It's interesting, just before we move on, the fact that your mum put you on a journalism course, I mean, we hear so much today about, you know, oh, career planning and career guidance in schools, and your mum just literally invented a career for you or decided this is what you should do.
She did, because she knew I loved English. You know, I had a voracious appetite for books. I always did. Mm. They probably weren't the books I should have been studying, but I read a lot. I loved writing, and my mother knew that. And she got me on the course, which was like, as I say, mothers know things, don't they?
They sure do. What was the life of a young journalist like in the 70s? I mean, you describe in your book the 70s to the 90s as golden days for the Dublin newspaper scene.
They were, because every story you did, you had to go out and do it. There was no, I mean, even telephones weren't very common in Dublin. I mean, remember when you used to advertise a house for sale with phone? I mean, houses didn't have phones around the place. Mm. There was obviously no internet or any of that stuff. So you actually had to go to courts, you had to go to houses, you had to go out and knock on the doors of bereaved families. You had to do all this stuff, and it was just adventurous. And then invariably, there was a gang every day would end up in the Oval or the Bachelor or one of the pubs discussing the day's events. There were legends working for us. We were working on legendary stories, like we covered the Dublin bombs and the Stardust and all those things, you know. There were things that leave a mark on you.
Which of the stories do you think, Paddy, left maybe the biggest mark on you?
Oh, with the Stardust, without a doubt. I mean, I had to go around, I think it was three houses when we eventually got all the names, and knock on the doors and ask the people about the young person they had lost and get a photograph of them, which sounds really hard. It sounds like cruel. It's not. I was never turned away, and I'd say in every single case, the families found it cathartic, you know, to talk about the person they'd lost. And it was just, in fact, on that occasion, when I got to the last of the three houses, I couldn't do it. I was in bits, and the taxi driver went in and did it for me, which I didn't admit either at the time. But he got the photograph and everything, but it was really, really tough. And then going to funeral after funeral after funeral, it was just soul destroying, because, I mean, we may be journalists and people might think we're hard, but we're not, we're just people.
You mention a lot as well, Paddy, about being a journalist, but also you mention drinking a lot. You even include a handy list of favourite pubs, many of whom are famous journalist hangouts. How serious at that time was the drinking culture?
It was very serious. I mean, one of the reasons for getting into it, and I must say I enjoyed my drinking before I ever got to the Indo, but if you didn't drink, nobody knew who you were. That's one of the sad things about it, that you had to really drink with the other hacks, editors included. Otherwise, no one would have, you just would have been anonymous. But it was a serious problem. There were guys coming in drunk at 8 o'clock in the morning. There were guys who at 11 o'clock went off and had two or three pints for their coffee break. And I remember at a conference asking a psychologist once why so many journalists became alcoholics. And he smiled and said they didn't. And I smiled back and said, I work in the Indo, they do. It's full of them. He said, no, he said, alcoholics become journalists. He said, people look for a job that will tolerate their predilections. And he said, it's the same reason paedophiles become priests and teachers, which at the time meant nothing to me. Mm. But in retrospect, I know what he was saying. But it was tolerated. That's the extraordinary thing. You know, I think that's gone. But one of the things about that being gone is that I'm not sure the camaraderie is there either now. There was great camaraderie, you know. everyone went to Mulligan's. The three newspapers used to go to Mulligan's. That was the kind of headquarters.
That really comes out from your book, Paddy, that camaraderie. And I suppose because of the intensity, the long hours, it tends to bind you all very closely together. So I assume it was really painful when your colleagues died tragically in the Eastbourne crash in 1984.
That was an extraordinary night. I was in Pat Gibbons nightclub at the time in Zhivago with some friends from Kerry. And I went to the bar to order some wine. And I heard the barmaid mention John Feeney's name, and I kind of said, I hope you're not saying anything bad about John Feeney. He's a friend of mine. And she said, you haven't heard. I said, heard what? And she said, go to your table, I'll bring over the wine. And I went back and said, barmaid's acting very strangely. And she came over and she said, I'm afraid John is dead, the plane crashed. And when she said that, I knew Niall was dead too, because we'd been talking about it that afternoon, Niall and I, before he went. Tony Hennigan had been talking about it the day before. And then I realised Kevin Moran was on it too. And it was very hard to take in. And I went straight to the office and met James Morrissey. We both went out to Niall Hanley's house. I met his wife and children and then went back to the office, having realised there was two pages in the paper the next day by John. So James and I wrote four obituaries and put them in there instead, and this went on and on again for days and days and weeks. But we got the paper out, and that's what they would have wanted us to do, and that's the tribute we paid to them, is bringing the paper out every day. It's still like yesterday. We all got very angry with the Sun at the time, because it ran a headline saying, nine die for a bottle of wine, because they were on the Beaujolais run. Nine die for a bottle of wine was how the Sun summed it up, which we found very offensive.
Do you think about them still, those friends of yours?
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah. I mean, all four were great characters. I knew Pat very well, some of the others vaguely, but those four were friends and colleagues. Mm.
Do you think as you get older, Paddy, life is so much about luck?
Oh, yes. There's an awful lot of luck involved in it. So, I mean, I got a fantastic career. I mean, it wasn't the most startling or sparkling career in history. I enjoyed it. I would never claim to be one of the great journalists of all time. I just enjoyed it. I had fun and some great experiences, and I got to see a lot of places and meet a lot of people.
There is lots of sparkle in your book, though. It's full of stories of international travel, junkets, concerts, sporting events. And I mean, you got easy access to people like John Wayne, Madonna, Pele. I mean, you'd never get that now.
Oh, you wouldn't. I mean, if you go through layers and layers of PR people and managers and all that these days, I can't imagine a Hollywood superstar sitting in the Gresham now and being able to walk up and sit down and have breakfast with him. Like, that's what happened with John Wayne. I just can't imagine that happening now. So I thank God for all the luck. I mean, there were bad moments too. I mean, I was fired as editor of the Tribune. I thought I was going to be editor of the Star twice and I wasn't. You know, you get disappointments, but that's life.
What was your biggest disappointment in your career?
Oh, I think the second time I thought I was going to be editor of the Star. In fact, I'd been told I was going to be. And then 4 days later, I was told I wasn't going to be. That was sad. And I think that probably equal to that was being fired as editor of the Tribune. I'd been ill for a long time. It was really, I suppose, only to be expected. I was in and out of work for weeks with illness. So it was the most incredibly talented team of journalists in that Matt Cooper had assembled, in fairness, in the Tribune. But unfortunately, they weren't given support by the Indo. They were given life support, if you know what I mean. Mm. Tribune was kept going to nibble at the Sunday Times. What they certainly didn't want was it for to attack the Indo, and it could have done. It was an extraordinary bunch of people.
You love music, Paddy. You talk about it in your book. You have a special growl for the Beatles. Lots of people do, but you have a particular reason. Why do you love them?
Well, I got a plaque put up to them, which I didn't think any ordinary citizen could do, and they can. I suggested a plaque to commemorate the Beatles. Two gigs in the Adelphi in Dublin, which of course I wasn't that, I was only a child. But I was amazed there was no mention. They only played twice in Dublin, both on the same day. Between the jigs and the reels, we got the plaque up. And thanks to Harry Crosby, Gay Byrne unveiled it. It was his last public appearance. It was a brilliant thing to have done, I mean, for the city to have done, I mean. And it was great to see Gay there, and he was in great form, talking about how the Beatles asked him to be their agent. It was brilliant.
What's your greatest achievement, do you think?
Oh, Charlotte, my daughter. No doubt. No contest there. I'd been ill for many years, and my wife had, at that stage had an almost fatal brain hemorrhage. And then we had Charlotte. So, I mean, she is very, very special to both of us. You know, she's 14 now, of course, nearly 15, 15 in a couple of weeks. So we're facing into something you've experienced more than once, teenage years. So,
yeah, she'll be great. Yeah. She'll be grand. If she's your greatest achievement, what's your favourite word, Paddy?
Dad. Dad. When she says dad, I never thought I'd hear the word. I mean, I was, 50-something when Charlotte was born, 51 or 2 or 3-something. So I wasn't sure I'd ever hear the word dad. Now when I hear it, that's my favourite word.
Are you religious, Paddy?
It's a bit like my rugby. I'm not as good as I think I am. I believe in God. Yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm an extremely bad Catholic. I'm a Spike Milligan Catholic. He said he was Catholic, but he didn't agree with a lot of what the church was doing. He thought Jesus would be annoyed with the church. I'm probably the same.
Do you believe in heaven?
I often think about it, Miriam. I certainly don't believe in people sitting around on clouds playing harps.
What a pity.
You know, I don't know. I think there is something, but I have no idea what it is. I mentioned a book to you about the priest in Mount Argus one Sunday who went to see his dying mother. And his mother was quite comfortable with dying, if you know what I mean. But this Sunday she was crying and he asked her why. And she said, because I don't know what's going to happen to me when I die. And he said to her, Mum, you went to Mass every day of your life. You're a good woman. You're going to heaven. And she got angry with him and said, how do you know? And he said, I confessed I don't. And nobody does. No one's ever come back and told us what it's like. You know, I think the one thing I think is good, if there is a heaven, is that I'd be smug with atheists. And the good thing is, if there's none, they don't get the chance to be smug with me.
As we close out today, Paddy, I've loved talking to you. And I notice in the book, you know, you call yourself an idiot a lot. Even on this call, you run yourself down, you know, a good bit saying you really weren't that skilled. I mean, why do you do that?
Because, I mean, I'm just an ordinary guy, did an ordinary job. Not an ordinary job, I suppose. Journalism is an extraordinary job, but I got lucky an awful lot. I got lucky to where I was born. I was lucky where I lived. I was lucky that my mother got me into journalism. My dad made me go to the Indo. I got a lot of luck. If I'd been let loose, I would be nothing. If I'd done my own thing. And I mentioned in the book Val Dunigan, whose father told him, when I die, people will say I was a great fellow. He said, well, I'm not. And nothing would give me greater pleasure than for you to say, I know, he told me. I think sometimes I do appear a bit arrogant. There are people who say I can turn any subject around to myself. And my friends have long ago learned not to say, how are you? Because I'll tell them. I like to just keep a lid on it.
Yeah, well, you have a disarming honesty. I love the last few lines in your book. I'm going to read them. They say, but there were some who liked me and a few who loved me. Well, they were all right, but as long as my family loved me, I really don't care. I hated nobody and I loved many.
That's about it. I never did hate anybody, no.
Paddy, I've loved chatting to you. Thanks so much. It's a great read. It's called And Finally, A Journalist's Life in 250 Stories by Paddy Murray, and it's published by the Liffey Press. Stay well, Paddy, and thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Miriam. Bye-bye.